What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, Shoulder Rehab Tips and Tricks. I've got my friend Ryan Collins, who did a lot of podcasting for me at the Memorial Hermann Workshop, actually saved me when I had pink eye and I couldn't even open my eye. It was a huge help. So, Ryan, I think I said thank you, but thank you again. That was a huge
You need
help.
To post a picture of your eye on...
I did. I think I did.
Like on a website somewhere so it's permanently sitting there.
Okay, maybe I'll put it up on... I'll see if I still have it. I switched phones, so hopefully I still have it. And, of course, Bubba Wilson. And then joining me again is Matthew Ferrix. He's working on starting his own podcast, and so this is his second time here on the Sports Medicine Broadcast. And he's going to kind of take over a little bit more of the hosting part of the show today. And so he's going to be kind of leading the questions, talking to Ryan about shoulder rehab tips and tricks, and then hopefully get into some weird things that he's seen or had to deal with. And I mentioned before, I saw a video of a guy one time who was born without clavicles. Like, it was crazy. Like, he crawled through this little tiny tube because, you know, he could bring his shoulders all the way in, that kind of thing. Anyways.
We could probably 3D print him some.
Yeah, we could now, huh?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Anyways, so we'll be looking for some weird stuff. And if you're watching in the live stream or anything like that, then you can definitely drop those comments in there. Of course, I'm Jeremy Jackson, the host. This is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/shoulder rehab. And the joining the conversation, just go to facebook.com/sportsmedicinebroadcast or sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/facebook. Either way, you should be able to find it. And then without much further ado, we're going to get right to it. So, Matthew, why don't you take it away?
Being that we're talking about shoulder rehab, Ryan, I just want to see, when you get a patient with shoulder surgery, shoulder pain, how do you like to start? Like, what's your general consideration? Like, how do you like to start with that patient before you jumping into their exercises and programs?
Yeah, so whenever I'll start an evaluation, I like to just kind of hear what their main issues are. So you can have pain that doesn't limit your emotion. You can have pain that limits your motion. You can have people that say, I don't care what kind of pain I have, I'd still go through it. So the biggest thing is I look for what their limitations are in their daily life, because that's gonna tell me, you know, what they've been able to do, what they haven't been able to do, strength-wise, if it's gonna be a more of a muscular effort, muscular strength, if there's gonna be a flexibility thing. So I like to get an overall overview of what their deficits are. And then once I kind of get an idea of the history of what they've been able to work themselves through, you know, I'll say, all right, well, show me what hurts. And looking at their motion, you can see obviously active motion. If there's going to be a painful arc, you're gonna see. If you have good scapular mobility, upward rotation, you can kind of start to just kind of pinpoint some of the issues that down the road through the examination you can kind of put together. Well, we're going to have issues with you know, scapular thoracic mobility. We're going to have issues with glenohumeral mobility. And so just kind of stepping back, doing my best to not go right into isolation stuff, but kind of get the big picture first.
Yeah, I definitely think that's a key point, kind of looking at everything. Is there, do you like to start kind of like with examination type stuff, kind of look at the whole shoulder as aspects, see if anything's tight or what's bothering them the most, or how do you like to look at that? Do you like to do your examination?
Yeah,
like special tests, stuff like that?
So, yeah, well, really just start off saying, okay, you know, once I know what bothers them, so let's say, you know, hey, I'm I'm having trouble reaching overhead, or I'm having trouble, you know, if it's a sport, an athlete, you know, throwing, pulling, pushing. And just with their history, they'll tell me the movements that I need to kind of take the next step towards. So if it's a thrower, right, what part of the windup, what part of the throw tends to give them the most pain? Or if it's I have pain throughout the entire motion, what have you noticed about your throwing that you've lost? So if you've lost accuracy, if you've lost strength, you know, it after I throw, before I throw, I warm up and it gets better, or I throw 30 throws and now my shoulder bothers me. So once I kind of have that history taken, you know, I'll step back, like I said, and just look at them move. So the examination, I don't want to go right into let me put my hands on you, because typically as a therapist, sometimes hands on is good, but as soon as you start pushing and kind of moving things around, you can potentially piss the shoulder off. And now you've totally ruined the rest of your examination because they're already in pain. And so if I can get as much painless or pain tolerable examination done before I get in there and start doing my special test that I know I'm looking for, whether it's pain provocative or if it's specific to a cartilage or a muscular tear, I want to get all the other examinations done first before I go in there and kind of upset that shoulder. So I'll step back, have them do overhead motion, overhead flexion, abduction, reach behind their back, kind of doing some functional external rotation, internal rotation stuff, just to kind of see, all right, if there's a lot of flexion and internal rotation stuff, that leads me to a certain area of the shoulder I need to look at. If it's painful in the front of the shoulder, they have a history of, I went through a program of 100 push-ups a day. You'll hear that. I'm going to get in shape, so I'm going to do 100 push-ups a day. And they have a lot of pain in the front of the shoulder. That's going to tell me a lot of potentially what started that issue and where we can go from there. So I said the history is huge. You can typically find out a lot of your examination based off of their history, just as long as you're asking the right questions. And those questions aren't just broad and generalized. You start to kind of focus in and get a little bit more tunnel vision as those questions become more clear on what you need to look at.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I totally agree about the history and trying, like, they're kind of painting you the picture already before even, I know, examining them and putting your hands on them. Like, I definitely can see where you're coming from on that one.
Yeah.
Moving on from that then. So thing I always like to say about the shoulder is there's so many things I can go on. I think when it comes to shoulder injuries, rehab part, I think you can go in a lot of different directions. So just in general, like, moving on now to like the rehab program, where do you mostly like to start with most of the patients that you see?
Well, I like to get them moving through a pain-free motion first. So you obviously want to make sure they have a good muscular balance, right? Rotators, your scapular movement. If you have your typical student posture with your forward posture, forwardly rotated scapula, upward rotated or downwardly rotated scapula, the hunchback posture of a student who's been sitting at a desk, an older person who no longer has thoracic extension. You got to look at the big picture. A muscle put in an optimal position is going to produce optimally. So if you can't get them in a good position to start, you can't expect them to then improve their activation. You can't expect them to improve their motion. So I look at, first off, the big picture, can I get them in a good position to start with? And then how much pain-free motion can they move through? So if it's acute pain, where do you feel the most pain? Can you move through this? Okay, well, if you can move through this pain-free motion, right, can we improve that just with changing your posture? Can we improve that with slight tweaks versus chronic pain? Okay, well, has your pain changed? Do you have painful days? Do you have non-painful days? Right, so I'll start with just trying to get them to move as much as possible in a pain-free range, because a lot of times if it's a chronic issue, you have muscular deactivation, you'll have atrophy. Just getting blood flow going, just getting some type of exercise started is going to help them in the start moving in the right direction. So if there's an anterior shoulder pain, we're talking potentially biceps tendonitis or just a anterior glumeral slide whenever they're doing their exercises. A lot of people have tried to do something in the gym to improve their shoulder health. Just having them show me what they've done. So give me the exercises you are doing. What have you done in the past? And then starting to make sure they're not doing something that's continually keeping their shoulder irritated. So fixing the exercises they've done in the past, if they're continually exercising first, will help them say, okay, don't wait for me to tell you to do everything. You're doing some things right. Let's kind of fix the things that you're doing wrong and keep you moving. All right, you don't want to totally shut them off from exercise and just be the only sole person that tells them what to do. Ideally, you want to develop independence. And so, fixing their exercises and then making sure that they're moving through as much pain-free motion as possible with their exercises to get them moving and keep them moving.
Right. Bubba, where do you like to start when you do your shoulder rehabs?
It's really difficult though, because you have a decrease in motion and you have this decrease in strength, and where's the happy medium between the two? Because if we hammer one side, we're neglecting the other aspect that's missing. And so it's really, really tough. We've got to restore full motion, pain-free, but we've also got to have strength to do that at some point. But again, if we work just strength and we're not working motion, we're losing and we may be creating other issues. I think, and we talked about this in one of the other podcasts about this subject, but going back to, we talked about the history again just a second ago, but you also got to go back and know what their sport is and what position they play within that sport. If Ryan's got a linebacker in his clinic that's got shoulder problems, okay, well, you got to be suspect of posterior instability just from taking on blockers and falling and different things. But also, as we go along, how he, or even one of us in the athletic training room, how we rehab that individual in that end stage, we can't neglect their position in their sport. That lineman or a linebacker is a total different animal than an overhead thrower or swimmer or a golfer, right? And we've got to, there's basics, just like quad set straight leg raises, you know, for a knee, there's basics in the shoulder. And I think we all have our go-tos on that, you know, external rotation, scaption, maybe some rowing were some of my early ones I would do that, because most everybody sucked at that if they were coming to see you. But as we get to that end stage, and I'm sure we'll lead into that more later this program, but we've got to then adapt, and I want you to touch on this a little bit later, Ryan, but we've got to adapt and say, okay, now within your sport, within your position or specialty within that sport, how do we address that so you can function at your best level and function optimally as you get back into that?
Right, yeah, I totally agree with that. So starting with pain-free motion, then I kind of want to go into what are, like, are there strengthening exercises, like certain muscles that you like to start with? Like, what's your kind of, like, go-to, like, moving on from that pain-free motion, like passive and active range of motion stuff? Like, where do you like to go to next?
So I think that one of the biggest things you have to restore, you know, is overhead flexion, right? Mm-hmm. Getting that full mobility. Now you can't achieve overhead flexion fully if you have a loss of internal external rotation down in neutral position, either in the scaption position, because the rotation is going to affect certain parts of the capsule, certain parts of the cuff, and so if you have posterior cuff tightness, limiting your internal rotation down below 90 degrees, good luck trying to get full overhead flexion whenever you're tightening up that posterior and inferior cuff. So I like to do initially, so we talk about pain-free motion, how are we restoring pain-free motion? With the shoulder, closed chain activity takes away some of those stresses in the shoulder because the stability requirements are reduced. And obviously we know our rotator cuff, our biceps, all the muscles that surround that glenohumeral joint, their primary purpose is to keep the ball from falling out of the socket, right? And if you have these athletes, they're going to probably have beaten up a lot of those passive structures that surround the shoulder because of that dynamic activity and high forces going through it. So those active stabilizers are having to work a lot. And so if you have this pain in open chain motion overhead, especially in our 90-90 abducted position, a lot of that is just the stabilizers. Either there's a muscular imbalance, or we have, anytime you have pain, you have a decrease in activation. Putting them into, let's say, a quadruped position, adding in that closed chain stability, now you can have them do like a rock back and see that their flexion has increased 20 degrees just because they no longer have to just do an open chain motion. Their open chain stabilizers and activators aren't having to do all the work. And so you can get a lot of mobility, active mobility in that position from the closed chain position. And then once you've kind of seen, all right, now look, we get this going, let's move to an active assisted type of open chain. So for me, pain-free, okay, now we got at least 120, 104 degrees of flexion. I'll get them on an incline table using a foam roller. So the assistance is basically they're resting their arm on that foam roller, if you can imagine, on an inclined table. So their arm is resting on that foam roller, but they're going through about 120 degrees of motion. So, Rhino has a big article on individualizing all the important muscle groups in the shoulder. And the the serratus anterior, which is one of the primary upward rotators of the scapula, which is huge for shoulder flexion, is best activated at 120 degrees. And so if that's one of the issues, is that they just don't have good scapular mobility and coordination between the STJ and the glenohumeral joint, then getting that upward rotation restored with some assistance to take away from the rotator cuff, you get that repetitive grease the groove flexion. So having them go through an active assisted incline flexion to that 120, really focusing on scapular rotation and protraction and retraction, you can just get them to activate over and over again, kind of like Bubba mentioned, like with the knee, just getting that quad set quad activation started, turn the engine on, and then once you get that engine running, you can start to do more and more. So, you know, having a progression from least stability requirements to moderate stability to full open chain, you know, getting them in those positions, getting them back to sport, I think is a good way to get started. The idea is, if you can teach them to move without pain, right, mm-hmm. they're likely going to be able to do more, and they'll continue to move. And say, all right, my shoulder's not a piece of junk. I can actually do something. And then as your job as a therapist and a trainer is to get them to feel the effect of the exercise to make it productive, right? If they feel like it's productive, they feel like they're doing some type of exercise, you can get them moving forward in the right direction.
Yeah. So just moving on from that then, coming from my part, because I know our patients probably differ a little bit. So when I'm seeing a kid, they're already doing kind of functionally strong. So when I'm seeing an in-season kid, I have to somehow maintain that strength. So I'm doing a lot of like band work, mm-hmm. you know, the traps, rotator cuff muscles. Do you incorporate same kind of exercise with the patients that you see?
Yeah, so in season, ideally say, let's pick a sport, let's pick baseball, because that's gonna be a big shoulder, any throwing athlete. In season, you wanna make sure you can maintain mobility. Once again, go back to Reynolds, since he's kind of a big cog in shoulder rehab. Articles he's put out shows that you can throw a bullpen, you can, you know, pitch in a game and immediately lose internal rotation and horizontal adduction, because that posterior cuff, that eccentric stress, has caused those muscles to tense up, tighten up. And so maintaining that mobility, you get that muscle to restore its full motion, you start to reduce some of that stress. And then throughout the downtime, or if they're, let's say they're in a return to throwing program, making sure they are maintaining that full range of motion, right? So flexion and internal rotation and horizontal adduction are the biggest movements that have been found to be reduced following a throwing program, following a pitch count, following a bullpen. So I think the biggest thing in season is to make sure the big areas that typically are stressed are maintained or normalized, right? So the motion is there, the strength of those posterior cuff muscles, you keep those going. Now, if it's a linebacker, right, you probably don't want to do a whole lot of push-ups and bench press and stress that posterior aspect of the shoulder. Rather than, you want to make sure you maintain that scapular mobility, right, scapular strength and stabilizer, so when they get that posterior stress into the shoulder, right, it's not all going to the same spot that you have them in game in season. You know, baseball players, do you want to do a lot of repetitive high velocity 90-90 stuff, or do a lot more endurance, maybe a little bit slower, focus on the stability of it, right? So the big word is joint centration, right? The ability to keep that joint centered in on the glenoid.
Centration, is that in Webster's now?
It will be.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, keeping the muscles doing their job. So if that ball starts to slide, you get that anterior pain, you get that anterior humeral glide. So focusing on keeping the ball centered in the joint, because whenever you are throwing, or when you are lifting, or when you are taking on a block, right, the best thing for that shoulder is to be able to maintain its proper position, and let the other big areas, the big muscles, kind of absorb that force. So in season, I'd say for sure maintain good mobility.
Because I'm just thinking about this, in season's obviously the toughest animal there is versus off season or post-operatively, because you're shut down, right?
Yeah.
If post-operatively, but talking about that, so one of the things, let's just take a baseball player. Would you have them foam roll in some of those positions you talked about after pitching, or would you do it the next day?
Well, I think
day of, next day.
So the articles talked about literally after the game seeing loss in mobility.
So doing it that night.
I would day, have them do some type of light mobility to regain blood flow, right? You want to make sure there's blood flow to an injured structure if that structure is being stressed or pulled on. Doing some type of low-level activation just to make sure that they're staying turned on. Anytime you have pain or discomfort or tightness, you can kind of decrease some of that.
There's some maybe like a rhythmic stabilization.
Right, so those types of things. Obviously, you don't have to replicate what they did in the game since they just, threw 100 pitches and then warmed up and then cooled down. So, you don't need to go in there and do a lot of med ball tossing the day of or the day after. But for sure, like I said, you want to address that mobility sooner rather than later. I think foam rolling to your lats and your posterior cuff, getting those racquetballs going in there is a great way. Day of, next few days, just to kind of keep everything moving for that acute in-season athlete.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad we're going into the baseball now, because I think a lot of the times what we deal with is the softball versus baseball pitcher, and how do those kind of shoulder rehabs differ between the two, basically just those two pitchers?
That's interesting. I don't typically see a whole lot of softball pitchers. It's obviously a less stressful position. Now,
a lot of slaps in those though.
You get the bicep stress more so than you'd get the rotator cuff stress, but I guess that's unfortunately my area of town, I don't get to see a lot of them. But for sure, you need to make sure that the mobility is there and that they're getting the proper drive through their legs and not just arming it, right? What have you seen?
I still think some of it is similar yet different, if that makes sense, in that it's still mobility. I think it's still scapular motion, good rhythm. All those things have to be there regardless of what position you're putting your hand in to release a ball. And again, you see a lot of slap tears and stuff in the softball pitcher, because of course it's not bad for the arm, so we can pitch 400 innings in a weekend with one person. But some of it is still the same. The basics of the joint motion and the joint stability and the rhythms and all that are, I think, no matter what, have to be addressed and taken care of.
Well, anytime you're throwing, it's that repetitive stress. So any type of repetitive stress is going to do some type of damage, whether it's at a good stable position or a unstable position, right? The idea is to get the bigger areas to improve their ability to absorb that force, right?
Right.
You can't change the fact that they threw 100 pitches, 400 pitches, whatever. A softball pitcher can pitch a lot more frequently. Does that mean that they're not hurting themselves as much? No, they're probably evening out the stress because they're pitching more frequently than a baseball pitcher.
Right.
And so recovery is ideal. You're looking, you want to make sure that thoracic mobility, scapular mobility is there, right?
And I think, and you talked about the big areas, and we've talked about this before. You got to look at, and I know it's the wrong verbiage, the core. You got to work the core, and you got to get the lower body strong. And you've got to have a connection between upper and lower to be able to transfer to, put that ball where you want it in a speed that you want it to be there. And so, we got to make sure as in season, out of season, post-operatively, to me, we got to be addressing those other things too. We can't just work on that shoulder. You got to go in and get the lower body strong in the weight room. And you got to be, and I think there's differences, how we work the plant leg versus the drive leg. There's some things that cross over, but we've got to do some isolations, in my opinion, and we've got to work the core and make sure there's a connection there so they can transfer from pushing off the rubber or turning a double play and get the ball either to the plate or to the base or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was in my grad assistantship, I was with softball for my 2 years there. So I kind of got quite a bit of knowledge on that one, basically with the softball pitcher. And a lot of the stuff, it was not so much of just the shoulder strengthening. It was a lot of more core, low back, hit the lats and stuff like that is what we focused on more there. especially trying to keep their velocity up, especially during in season, because most of those girls are pitching on average three games a week. So difficult trying to keep them strong through the whole year was always the battle, that especially when we had like 60 some games right. In about a 4 month period. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad we kind of brought up the core one, because that was going to be one of my next questions we'll hit on earlier, is when it comes to your shoulder rehab and stuff, is do you guys like to put in core exercises? Because I know when I'm doing shoulder programs, is I almost think of like the shoulder and hip is almost like a chain. They're kind of working together. And I think that shoulder can work a little bit better if the core is strong as well. So I just want to see what you guys kind of think about that as well.
Yeah, I think whenever when you throw the ball, obviously you're transferring, like Bubba mentioned, you're transferring through the floor, through the ground, up into the arm, and that core is that major area for energy transference. And a weak core, you know, we keep calling it core, you know, the abdominal muscles, your lats, all of that.
It's core because that's what everybody knows.
Right, it is, so yeah. Just that mid-trunk area, right? That if you have an energy leak there, then you end up having to either, you know, change your mechanics, or you force that velocity from, you know, you lose that velocity, or you force the velocity through the arm, and then you get that overuse. So I think, obviously, your obliques, and you can basically just look at the injury history. You know, what muscles, right, are people getting sidelined for? And it's a lot of internal, external oblique. The lats are huge. You're seeing, I mean, pitchers with lat tears, throwers with lat tears, abdominal strains. Mm-hmm. There's a great amount of velocity, of trunk rotation, of anti-rotation, of anti-extension whenever you're arching back to throw. I mean, that the trunk is obviously is highly involved in a movement that's, you know, that's repetitive. And that's the hard part, is that it's, if you say, all right, let's do you know, 30 Russian twists and 50 crunches, you know, but then you go throw 400 pitches, you know, are you getting an appropriate volume, right? Let's finish this exercise off with a 5 minute plank, right? We're going to work a core. Oh, it's burning. Okay, we did a good core workout. But does it transfer over? Does it have the, you know, the said principle aspect,
right,
of what you're doing on the field? And I think that's where the core training should really kind of key in on, is how do we get the best transference from the gym to the field?
You know, I've said it before, there's a reason baseball pitchers go on the DL for a blister on their toe, right? And so, if we can't transfer and transfer appropriately in a pattern that is functional to allow us to do what we're trying to do, we know that the forces of throwing a ball just through the ulnar collateral ligament are greater, you know, so everything else has to be working to do that. But there's a stat out there at one time that was 25% of the salary spent on Major League Baseball pitchers was spent for them while they were on the DL. That's a ton of money. Knowing that a quarter of the money you're spending on your pitchers are going to be wasted because they're on the DL. That's huge. And so I don't know. Well, I've got ideas. This isn't the forum. We've talked about it before, Jeremy. But something's got to be done, because let's be honest, that damage 99 times out of 100 to that pitcher isn't done in their third year of the major leagues. That damage was probably done, started at 12 years old, playing two summer league teams, a fall league team, and a team or two in the spring, because we can only, you know, have so many pitches before something breaks. That rubber band, how many times can you pull it, or that paper clip, how many times can you bend it before it finally breaks? And so we've got to figure that out, but that's way beyond me. At some point, Major League Baseball is going to just say, man, we're not going to draft you, you know, because we're not going to pay the money to try to repair you later. Well, I mean, looking at that,
yeah, you know. I think, I mean, you look at the Astros a few years ago with Brady Aiken, they saw a change or a potential for injury in his UCL, and caused a big stir in Houston, but also in the major leagues, in that they decided to adjust their signing bonus and their you know, contract based off of what they found on an apparently uninjured elbow. And it you know, they lost him, and they got a draft pick for it, and ended up being Alex Bregman, which was nice. But he ended up tearing his UCL about a year later. So, right. I mean, it's, you know, it's interesting. You don't, you know the stresses, and you're starting to see these areas of high levels being applied there, and you're like, well, it's dangerous, right? You know, do you take the chance that it doesn't affect it, or do you
Would you draft him in the second round, or you draft him in the 20th? I mean, yeah. You know, that's what it boils down to, and you're right. Are we going to give you 1.5, or are you going to get, you know, two large pizzas and a 12-pack? I mean, for your signing bonus. That's what it's going to come down to at some point.
Yeah.
Looking at, okay, how many innings has Jeremy thrown since he was 12 because mom's posted everything on the internet, you know? And they're going to look at that and go, ooh, no, that's crap tissue. We're not going to, you know, do that. Or, you know,
he went from
a second baseman to a shortstop in high school to started throwing late in high school. Well, he's got some miles left on him, so he's got some potential. That's a different animal, you know, than the kid that was a pitcher only from 10. And I think all that plays, all that being said, plays a part in all of this. You know, again, we've all seen the player that's the inverted triangle. You know, the athlete that great upper body and he's got twigs for legs. Well, what is he playing in what position? Because he's at some point he's, you know, ripe for a breakdown, depending on what he's doing.
Yeah, and I think going back to kind of the core and the training, you know what areas of the body are going to get that repetitive stress. And so you don't always need to be putting those areas in stress in the gym or off the field. So, you know, hitting the core, knowing that, all right, we need that internal external oblique activation. We need that anti-extension so that they don't have that rib flare whenever they're in their layback position, right? You get a lot of low back pain from, you know, that lordotic posture and that compression of the lumbar spine because they are hyperextending at the lumbar region versus, you know, getting their thoracic extension. You know, looking at those areas, I think you can save a lot of in-season, off-season stress to a repetitive area by kind of knowing how to program accordingly. Program appropriately to build up those areas that protect and transfer force, making it easier on those, you know, the susceptible structures.
Yeah. Going away to, I just kind of want to change a little direction here to the non-athlete. Say just your normal person comes in. Yeah. Do you like to interpret more
person.
With their interpret abdominal muscles with their program, like when you're in clinic?
Yeah. So
a big test for me,
I'll do is, you know, if they have shoulder pain, I have trouble changing a light bulb or reaching up to the top of my shelf. I'll put them, their back against the wall. Right. And basically have them try and keep their arms straight and raise their arms overhead and touch the wall behind them. And what I inevitably see is a lot of lumbar extension, right? For one, their head probably can't even get against the wall. So their head posture's forward, right? And they get here and they're stuck right here. And when they do touch the wall, it's because they extend fully through their lumbar spine and they say, look, I can touch the wall. And so what you're looking at is you're looking at a lot of compensatory motion. You're looking at some soft tissue issues. You're looking at spinal compensations where they don't have thoracic mobility, but they do all their mobility through their back. And what you end up with is poor overhead flexion. So then you're getting more of an acromial impingement versus actually having that appropriate upward rotation of the scapula to clear that space. So that's one of my big, if you want to call it non-athlete assessments, is do you have appropriate motion at all the appropriate levels? Do you have a potential for pain-free motion, or are you hitting the brick wall over and over again because you're basically stuck in this pattern where you aren't moving appropriately? So that one is a big one for me. You can do it also just laying on their back and kind of doing a more of a lat soft tissue mobility assessment, because the lats can definitely get tight. If you have an overhead, let's say it's a gym rat or recreational lifter, and they like to do overhead press, and they came in, and every time they do overhead press, their shoulder barks at them for 3 weeks. And you ask them, okay, well, show me what you can do, and they overhead press by arching their back and pressing up. So they're almost doing an incline press standing up. So I mean, obviously the stresses aren't being applied in the right area. So just kind of seeing the whole chain. Does the whole chain move appropriately? Does the whole chain work together appropriately? And that's going to give you a good idea what you need to work on.
the hard sell on those, to I think for all of us would agree, is, hey, we need to work over here, but it's my shoulder, you know. Right. And it's trying to convince them that, yes, but, and that's where, you know, you kind of talked about earlier, if you can get the motion going and it's less painful or pain-free, they'll buy in. If you can get a couple things going where they go, ooh, wait a minute, I got a little motion out of that and I feel better, doesn't hurt when I sit or whatever, maybe the buy-in comes. But that's tough.
And you're not going to get a 60-year-old to have perfect thoracic extension, right? And no. And you don't necessarily need to. And it could be that they just they don't have any scapular mobility. They haven't used their muscles in a long time. They've been sitting at a desk forever, and now they just don't have good activation of the right muscles. And so, kind of watching they're doing watching their scapulas move when they do that. They may have a straight spine whenever you lay them flat on their back, but they still just kind of get locked in. You know, it's kind of, you know, everybody's a little different, right? And so I think going back to the history is obviously important. What do you do the majority of your day? You know, the hour that you see them in a training room or a PT clinic and the 23 hours that they have outside of there, obviously the 23 is going to weigh heavier on their recovery and their symptoms than the 1 hour that you have with them. So,
well, and yours is more like, you know, 70 to 100 before, you know, of the 2 or 3 hours a week you get them. So
yeah, so it's I think the biggest thing is you want to kind of see the big picture of, well, one, do they need 180 degrees of overhead motion? Is that something that they need? And two, if they do have pain at 90, if they have a painful arc, right, you're looking at who's not doing their job, right? Is it a literally they have a rib flare every time they raise their arm because they haven't done an abdominal contraction in 60 years, right? And so you just got to work on, hey, turn this muscle group on, control your spine a little bit better, right? And in a pain-free, assisted, we're going back to like closed chain, active assisted, can you move more pain tolerable, or, you know, can you increase your range with a little bit of assistance? So
yeah, for sure. So moving on from that, I just want to kind of go into what's big for me, what I like to focus on the shoulders, some stabilization exercises. I'm kind of a big believer in those and with the patients that I normally work with. So I kind of want to see, like, what kind of stabilization exercise, like, do you like to do? I know it's always based on the patient, but are there some favorite exercises, like, that you know that are probably going to work, or?
Yeah, no, I got, I recently kind of changed my stability programming. I say recently, probably over the last year or so. Just for your typical, let's say typical individual, right? We'll go general population. I like to do a lot of farmer's carries, both at the side of the arm, down at, you know, we'll call a farmer carry, a waiter carry, and then an overhead carry. So when we're looking at a carry, typically I'll have them use a dumbbell down low and then kettlebells at the waiter in the overhead position. An upside down kettlebell really helps the stability requirements, one, because it forces your grip to really increase. And as we know, anytime you squeeze down at your wrist flexors and extensors, you get your grip going, you have that irradiation effect going up into the shoulder to increase that rotator cuff activation. So that that can improve it as well. But also with that kettlebell kind of wanting to go side to side, whether you're here or here, that shoulder inside, those fine motor, those smaller adjustments are having to be made to keep the arm from wanting to do this, right? So me sitting there slapping them around, I have them doing something somewhat functional in that they're carrying things, but they have a full arm, if you want to do a full chain of activation to get those muscles to keep that ball centered in the joint. So going back to that joint centration. So if they can't go ahead.
You mentioned the kettlebell upside down. And so I think 2-3 years ago at the Memorial Hermann Clinic, you actually did one of the breakout sessions showing this.
Yeah.
And since then, that's actually one of the things I've incorporated into my regular workouts is I'll hold the kettlebells and do like a bicep curl and then do like an overhead press.
Yeah.
And it is so much harder than using the dumbbell because the leverage or the lever arm is further out there doing the bicep curl, but then also just the stability, the wobbliness of getting it up there. And so I really like doing it. And you're also able to decrease the weight, and so you're not like
no, it doesn't take much weight at all.
Yeah. Exactly, and so that and that's a positive because when you do have somebody who's in pain who can't tolerate that resistance, and it's also a focus of the exercise. What's the purpose of your exercise? So a kettlebell overhead press is going to be more of a stability challenge than it is a strength challenge. You still get the strength aspect of it. You still get the upward rotation and the scapular movement aspect of it, but you're asking those active stabilizers to really kick in gear, because they have to work harder with that instability of the kettlebell. And I like doing overhead press with the kettlebell kind of teamed up with, let's say, a barbell lift, one of my big strength movements, just to make sure, because you know, we know left arm, right arm, whatever hand dominant you are, they're going to move slightly differently. So anytime you team them up on a barbell, you potentially are asking one shoulder to do something it's not great at. So that upside down kettlebell press is a great way to really get those active stabilizers to kick in. And like you mentioned, the less weight for somebody who is coming from a surgery or an acute injury who can't tolerate the load, it's a great way to get them moving pain-free.
Yeah. Continue.
Sorry. So yeah. Anyway, so the
way to jump in finally.
Yeah, the carries overhead and the weighted carry, getting that rhythmic stabilization. So it's not me having to lay them on a table. It has them walking. And then anytime you have somebody standing up holding something, the whole body is involved. So every time they step, they walk, they have to say, all right, I can't have a wobbly spine and expect this kettlebell to stay in place.
Right. You've activated the core.
Right. So you get the whole kinetic change. So that's one of the big ones I do. If I have them laying down, there's an exercise I'm going to give credit to Dean Somerset, an exercise guru trainer that I follow. He does this kettlebell screwdriver. So imagine you're in a supine position on the table, right? What you do is you have that same upside down kettlebell and you're basically going through internal rotation and external rotation. And the idea is you're trying to screw drive or screw in the screw on the ceiling or whatever, trying to not strip that screw by going crazy with that that movement. So you're trying to stay in place. So imagine you're centrating the joint, right? And then you go from that flexion position, which is a little bit more stable, you rotate and turn onto your side. So now you're in an abducted 90-90 position. Oh, and do the same thing. So internal rotation, external rotation in a 90 position. So they're really having to keep that ball centered on the glenoid while they're doing that rotation. So it's a little bit less challenging, but it's really more focused on the stability aspect of those active stabilizers. And you can get somebody who has anterior impingement, anterior glide or posterior impingement to say, all right, if you can stay in the center of the arm of the joint, you can get that rotator cuff to activate without that pain, right? Can you find a position where you're using those muscles and you're showing your shoulder, you're proving to yourself that you can stay in a good position to move? And then, you know, final, I guess, big step towards the end, Turkish get-ups are great, right? You can do that with anything. You can do that with a dumbbell, kettlebell. You know, you got crazy people doing them with barbells. I mean, it's the Turkish get-up is just a good. You got a linebacker who can squat 400 pounds, but he jacked up a shoulder, so his legs and his core are probably pretty good and pretty in shape. Doing a Turkish get-up, you can at least get a full body component of that shoulder exercise. So those are kind of the ones that I've added into my programming. Obviously, you know, doing some isometric walkouts with TheraBands, things like that. I still do some rhythmic stabilization on the mat for lower level people. I do have a problem. I'm going to go ahead and jump on a soapbox real quick. When people just sit there and slap the arm around, right? Where's the muscular activation? How are you getting the muscle to activate if you don't give it time to turn on? If you go from a flexion challenge to an extension challenge to an abduction challenge to an adduction challenge within 2 seconds, how do you get the muscle time to actually turn on? So I like to actually prefer to slow it down. So have them say, so my cue is, all right, you want to resist my movement. So as soon as I feel them turn on their muscle, I'll switch to the next one. But if I push it and they move and I go right to the next one, and then basically I'm just doing this with their arm,
they're never activated.
Where's their activation? How are they involved in that exercise? And so I tend to slow it down, have them resist it. Once I feel that they kind of resist that movement, I'll move on to the next one, just so that I know I'm getting a contraction of all those areas.
So on that, do you feel like in any time, because one of the things with the ankle, when they're working the bands, I'll kind of like oscillate the band, so it's not just the same thing. because in sports they're not just pulling their foot straight up or straight to the side. And so should it be that like I'm moving it more slowly, just changing the angle with the band? Or are you saying specifically with rhythmic stabilization of the shoulder?
Well, I think anytime you have stabilization, you want to make sure that they're turning on the muscle. You're not, you know, you're not passively stabilizing their joint by continually giving them a new stress, right? So if you pull them down, but then you immediately pull them up, right? You're keeping them in the same position, right? If you continue to pull them down and they lose that position, right? You'd like to know that they can resist that movement, right? So that you know that those muscles are engaged. So if you're pulling them into a plantar flexion position, you'd like to know that their dorsiflexor is turned on. So I would just want to make sure if I'm pulling them down that they are resisting it. I can feel that they resist that movement before I move on to the next one. And then as those muscles activate faster and faster, yeah, you can increase the speed. But I don't see the point of just shaking them around without knowing that they're activating, right? That's the whole point of the exercise to me, is to make sure that they're able to engage in whatever position I put them in.
You're doing the right thing in the wrong way at times, you know, by doing that.
Yeah, right? Well, I mean, just the productivity of the exercise is limited because you're not giving them that opportunity to engage.
Right.
Bubba, do you have any stabilization exercises that you like to use?
No. I like rhythmic stabilizations. I actually did know about going slower. I may have learned it from him or one of my other people. I think they're important. Because I like the body blade. I like the body blade for some of that. Yeah. How many kids have you ever given that to that just can't function, right?
Almost 90%, I would say.
Right. I mean, they can't abduct and do that thing, you know, pronated, with, you know, and they can't do that. And so, all right, let's lay down on the table, you know. And so I think it's really important, and it's – You see some benefits once they can figure that out.
Yeah.
As you go and they get that rhythm and that stabilization going, you can make some inroads. But I like the body blade. I like hands-on stuff when you have the time. It's a little different in Ryan's environment when you can schedule your patients versus, you know, we get that influx of 30 to 40 in an hour. Mm-hmm. But when you can do that, a little bit of hands-on goes a long way. But I am a fan of rhythmic stabilizations, you know, going from the table where the scapula is stabilized on the table to doing those to, you know, coming up in more of a, you know, upright standing open chain position of doing these, you know, and there's stuff you can do on the wall with a ball and you can get creative. But I think they're really important.
I can't go without mentioning you can't discount closed chain stability exercises. And I think those would be the, you know, the initial or the early phase type of stability. Because when you, like we talked about before, when you do closed chain, you get a little bit more of an activation, coactivation of everything. So it's a little, I would say it's easier. It's just going to be less stressful initially. And so, you know, progressing a bird dog from leg kick to upper body, lower body, to throwing a band on there, to putting them on Air X's, to, you know, actually doing some perturbations to their body while they're in a bird dog extended position. I think that definitely helps. Now, and what you look for in that position is not so much the arm moving, but you look for them to lose that scapular position. So if you say, all right, protract against the ground, right? So they get a little bit of an activation. But then as they go, they lose that and they go into a retracted position. You know, they're more or less hanging on their ligaments than actively keeping their shoulder steady in the socket. So I think, you know, obviously closed chain is a good way to introduce it. Just doing a simple leaning on the wall and raise one arm up, can you avoid falling into a retracted position? It kind of gives you some scapular stability as well as that glenohumeral stability.
Right. Yeah, to touch kind of what you guys thought, I'm a big fan of the body blade as well. I think that's a great tool that some people can use, especially what I found that was very beneficial was pitchers. You can really progress them. I've had pitchers even do their whole motion with a body blade. I also use the Bosu ball, flip it upside down. They're almost in a plank position, kind of doing that. I definitely think I'm on straight on with you guys. I think stabilization is a very key part, and those kettlebell exercises that you mentioned, Ryan. I think I'm going to have to start incorporating those as well. Moving on from that, I kind of wanted to go into maybe off of the little bit of the strength and exercise and stuff like that. When you're in clinic, Ryan, do you guys do use anything? Do you like do any like certain like mobilization techniques on some patients that are lacking like motion? I'm going to kind of go back a little bit because I don't think we really touched on many specific things. Are there like any mobilizations or glides or anything that you like to use on helping them get motion back? I know you mentioned the foam roller, but is there anything else?
Yeah, so for a lot of my throwers, and just in particular, anybody who's lost that horizontal adduction, so that's one of my big assessments for internal impingement, right? Because you have that typically that posterior cuff that's really tight and contracted, and you can't get a posterior glide, so you end up pinching there in the back when they go through external rotation. So, if, you know, going through your assessment, you have a positive relocation test where you reduce their anterior shoulder pain or posterior shoulder pain with that relocation test. That tells me they don't have the mobility posteriorly to allow that shoulder to be in a better position. So what I'll do a lot of times, if I've kind of figured that out and through my assessment and through their history, doing a more or less a horizontal adducted stretch to get them started. And then my glide is more of a lateral glide at the shoulder. So I'm really trying to stress out that posterior cuff. I can't tell you if I'm stretching out posterior capsule or posterior cuff. There's articles going back and forth. Do we actually change the posterior capsule? Is it what's tight, or is it the cuff, the muscle group that is just so contracted and tight that it's limiting the motion? I don't want to get into that conversation because I haven't read enough articles one way or the other that tell me. But I know that posterior area of the shoulder, getting that lateral glide and then going further and further across their body into that adductor position, they don't like it the further across I go. So I'm really tightening up and stretching out that posterior cuff and then adding in that posterior glide. So if I'm doing a lateral glide and then I'll put their elbow right here and I'll push down to get that posterior glide of the glenoid into that structure in the back, really lights up that back part. It's like, you know, if you can imagine doing just your typical grade one, grade two mobilizations into, you know, any joint. So, you know, you got your femoral posterior glide into the back, posterior structures of the knee, shoulder, posterior structures. I mean, that posterior glide to that musculature with that adducted position really addresses that area. And what you'll see pretty quickly, anytime you address the posterior capsule, posterior cuff, is you see improvements in internal rotation and overhead flexion. And so if you right off the bat, they have pain or they have trouble with that overhead flexion and internal rotation, those two tied together tells me posterior cuff, potentially inferior capsule, inferior immobility. And so I'll do that mobility first, follow it up with some active assisted, typically like quadruped motion. So I'm not going to immediately ask those muscles that I just stretched and moved to then activate when they go overhead. So I'll do that active assisted to take a little bit of muscular activation away, have them go through as much flexion as possible, right, with that new stretch, and then have them stand up, do some active assisted on the wall, and then potentially trying to get them to start doing a little bit of a lift off to start activating those muscles again. Just kind of gradually add in more activation to that area. And at home, you can do a simple, you know, cross body stretch where they lift up off the table. A lot of times I'll have them roll onto their arm, so bicep goes towards their sternum to get that posterior cuff stretch. And if you can get them to do that regularly and following it up with some gentle active assisted type stuff, whether it's closed chain or open chain, the repetitiveness of it, right, greasing the groove, however you want to call it, allows them to see improvements in that area, right? If they're just painful, they're going to avoid that motion. They're going to avoid it, or they're going to compensate. So, you know, that's where the history and the examination really kind of key in on, is if you can find areas that tie together, you know, posterior cuff tightness, internal rotation loss, flexion loss, you can give them just two exercises to do at home and see a big improvement in multiple ranges.
Yeah, most definitely. I know what I sometimes to use, especially with, you know, when they're lacking range of motion, I use the pulley or the T-bar a lot, kind of that active assistive type word of the motion. Do you ever use any of those, or do you more of like using those other tricks that you touched on?
You know, you go back, I think it's obviously patient dependent, you know.
Right.
So I have a rotator cuff who was shut down for 6 weeks after surgery. He had a mini open, and the doctor said, sling it for 6 weeks because I don't want this thing to rip apart. And inevitably, that's going to tighten you up, right? When you don't move your arm for 6 weeks, this guy is pretty tight. And so what I like about the T-bar is that it allows them to do some prolonged low-load stretching. I don't necessarily do it right back and forth, but it allows them to hang out there in that position for a while, which I think is important because, you know, I try and have them stretch in what I call pain tolerable ranges, where they can tolerate hanging out there for a while. Because as soon as you get to a 7, 8, 9, 10 on that, you know, rating scale, they're going to tense up and they're going to restrict their own motion themselves. And so if it's pain tolerable, they can hang out there. If it's an external rotated T-bar stretch, find the position, you know, all the different positions of the shoulder dictate what parts of the shoulder are tight. And so based off the examination, if they have some soft tissue tightness, I'm going to do it down here. If they have more joint tightness, I'm going to try and get them up a little bit higher and just basically have them sit there and kind of stretch it out. Doing some, you know, PNF activation, you know, contraction, co-contraction with it. So they're pushing against the bar and they relax and you push back a little bit. Then they push against the bar and they relax and you go back a little bit. Teaching them how to do that on their own. Once again, if you can have them hit those areas at home and they do it that 23 hours that you don't have access to them, you're going to see bigger changes.
I think, and I don't disagree with anything you said, but the most important thing to me that you said in that whole deal is 2 or 3 exercises for the home. The guys that get athletic trainer, therapist, doctor, it doesn't matter, that gives them 15 exercises, they do none of them.
Yeah.
You know, so if you can give them 2 or 3 that they can remember, that they can do right, you're going to get I think the gains are so much better because it's not like, well, I don't remember this one, so screw it. I just won't do any of them. I'll just wait till I go back the next time.
Yeah, and that's a big change that I've noticed with myself just because through experience, but also as a therapist, I want them to fix everything, right? And I see a lot of things wrong with some of my patients. And so I've had to really kind of accept the fact that these individuals are, you know, probably not as motivated. Or if they are motivated, right, there are big, I call the meat and potatoes of their program, that if they can get those better, some of the other areas just kind of fall in line.
Right.
Right. If I can't get a quad to turn on, well, I'm never going to get their glutes to engage when they squat. So if I can get their quad to engage and then eventually start working on functional transfers, well, yeah, we're working towards getting that compound movement pattern addressed. We're looking at that co-coordination of exercise mechanics to improve. So, yeah, I've definitely reduced the number of visits, stretches, and things like that because, you know, if you can kind of hit the big picture in clinic, you know that you've at least addressed that. And then if you want to do some leg raise stuff at home that's not as pertinent to what you're addressing, then that's fine. They'll do something easy like a leg raise or a calf stretch or a heel raise or something like that. So,
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, I definitely agree with the whole 2 to 3 because dealing with teenagers, if I give them maybe 4 or 5, then they start to forget most of them if it's not out on a printed, colored, coordinated, this is what you got
to
do.
They don't even know their locker combination. There's no way they're going to remember 4 to 5 exercises.
Well, so I've stopped giving them papers. I basically, before they leave my clinic, they have to take a picture with it on their phone. Because they're not going to lose their phone. It's attached to them. It's it doesn't even leave their hand. So they take a picture of their schedule. They take a picture of their exercises, right? So I could say, look, you know, you have no reason to not know what you're supposed to do. So paper goes. They're going to lose that in the car. You know, I don't know how you can lose a piece of paper in a car, but it goes away. but their phone, it's right there. So they have no excuse at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Ryan, like kind of over your time and your experience, let's come on to touch on, are there any like tricks or tips that you've discovered that work for you that you kind of want to share?
Tips or tricks? Well,
anything special that you might've picked up on the way?
So I think the biggest thing, so tips and tricks would be, I follow therapists and trainers that are smarter than me. And that's pretty easy.
So many comments.
and I don't pretend to be the smartest person in the room. And I want I want to be surrounded by people who know more than me and who are going to push the boundaries a little bit more. And then I'll put it into my programming. Now, I've done some exercises a year ago that I don't do today because I didn't see any improvement.
But that should be the case.
Right. And a lot of times I'll ask either one, I'll do it myself. So like Jeremy mentioned with the kettlebell, I did a lot of kettlebell work whenever I started getting into it, following Dan John and his kettlebell works, all the different guys that I follow, putting it into my own programming. And so I like to say, if I'm doing something in rehab for a patient, I've done it myself, especially the higher end stuff. So these higher end athletes who can't just stay on a band all day, right? They've mastered the band exercises. Now, I can tell you this, there are band exercises that I can keep progressing and challenging them allow me to say, all right, if you have this blue band, you have no reason that you can't do something at home. If they're throwing and you haven't started your throwing program yet, you can at least do blank, 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 right? So the tips and tricks for me, I mean, look, every exercise is going to affect somebody differently. So there's not one exercise that's the best out there. So for me, my tips and tricks would basically be follow people that are doing different things than you, right? Try it on your own. And then start to implement it into your programming with your patients. Do the ones that are, you know, the patients that aren't easily flared up in case it's a little too aggressive, right? So all the carries potentially can irritate somebody. You don't need an 80-year-old doing some overhead farmer carries. You know, that's not necessary. But
low ones, they got to carry groceries.
Right. I mean, yeah. I think my biggest thing is just try new things, because if I hadn't, I'd probably still be slapping somebody's arm on their back. And that's fine because there are still people that do it. But I know and I've seen that there are better ways to go about doing some of the basics. So coming out of school, you have a couple tools in your toolbox. You know, I've thrown some of those away and I still have some of those. But through the years, I've added tools, new tools, and I feel like that's what's really kind of progressed my programming, progressed my outcomes, is that I'm trying new things. And I'm also I'm being less generalized in my programming and getting more specific. So I don't do one scapular exercise, one rotator cuff exercise, one stabilization exercise. You know, if there's an area of need, I do a lot. My volume has changed. I put a lot of volume to that area because that's going to be what's going to make the biggest changes. I can't wait 6 weeks doing one exercise for this area to see a change. I need to see that area change. And like I mentioned, a lot of times if you hit one area, a lot of times the other areas improve themselves too. So yeah, try new things, follow people smarter than you, and then just make sure that with what you're addressing, you're putting your time and effort into
it. That's why I have no followers. But anyway. Yeah. Anyway. I'll beat you to it. That's.
Yeah, I'm not even on social media, so I don't attempt it.
I think I'll jump on my version of that soapbox. I agree with Ryan. I think you've got to follow people. You've got to look at new things. But the only way you can do that in some cases is you've got to put your butt in a seat at a conference. You can't. I have an issue with what I call the drive-by CEU person. Don't pay your money, show up, get your packet, and never be seen again. You know, I don't think you can learn everything you need to learn sitting in a seat, but you also can't learn everything you need to learn to advance by watching Instagram and you know, tweet posts. You've got to mix it up, and you've got to go talk to people. I still think there's something to be said for spending time in an ortho office or a doctor's office, depending on what it is, and going and watching surgery if you can. I don't need to go see 400 ACL surgeries over a couple of years, but I'm also the guy that, depending on what setting I'm in, that's explaining what's fixing to happen to that athlete or what just happened to that athlete surgically because they were drugged up when the doctor came in, right? What'd they do? Oh, no. Well, if I was there, if possible, or I can at least say, the odds are pretty good they did X, Y, and Z, and here's how they did it, and not know for sure. But you've got to be able to explain that to your athletes. And the more you know about their injury, i.e. the anatomy, the eval, the history, the programming of the exercises, knowing what they did surgically if possible, and then going and learning in other areas, you can't beat it.
All right, so similar to what you were saying, going to see surgeries. So one of the issues that I had is I could not go see surgeries because I didn't have a TB test. So we got TB tested for our adoption thing. So just a kind of quick update, we're kind of in the process. We're what they call fishing now. And so it's completely unrelated to the shoulder, but I have a TB test, so now I can go see surgeries.
Right.
So I'm excited about that opportunity because now I have the paperwork saying I have a TB test. So I just kind of
negative TB test.
Negative, yeah, yeah. And so
there's a difference. So, yeah.
It was actually extremely funny because one of my children, like, the doctor came out from a couple doors down saying, "Hey, is everything okay in here?" Like, just screaming, "I don't want a shot." And I mean, this kid is loud, but it just, you know, turns out everything's fine. He just freaked out. I don't know, whatever. So another funny story, another time.
Jeremy screaming in the
door. Yeah, it was Jeremy on his kid.
No, I do pass out when I get like blood taken or stuff like that. But again, that's not what we're talking about. So just kind of throwing that out there. I'm excited about being able to go now because I've tried and I was like, no, we don't have that. Okay. So make sure you ask early if you're planning to go see one of your athletes get surgery.
Yeah.
All right. Continue.
And just one little addition. I think when we mentioned following other people, don't just follow those in your profession.
Your field, yeah.
I've learned so much from strength and conditioning professionals, from personal trainers, therapists, chiropractors. You know, it just because you're a physical therapist or a trainer doesn't mean that a therapist and a trainer is going to be the one who tells you the latest and greatest. So there are obviously things that are above and beyond my pay grade and my patient's pay grade that I don't need to do in my clinic. But like I said, there's a lot of people out there with good ideas that you can get some good information from.
All right. So before we do the weird things that you may have seen, like I mentioned, the guy with no collarbones before, a couple of people that I saw checking in live on Facebook, Red Gainis, I'm sure he came to
Gainis.
Make fun of Bubba.
He does. Yeah.
Joey Vargas and John.
He may have
Harmon.
Been texting me a minute ago. So yeah,
he may have been. So again, just those of you that are checking in live, I really appreciate it. Dropping in comments, that kind of thing. But we're going to talk quickly about weird things or special considerations that you've seen, experienced, or anything you got like that.
I can start my own shoulder.
All right.
Posterior dislocation, which is about less than 10% of all dislocations, and I knocked the back half of the articular surface of my glenoid off at the same time.
Trying to be, what was that? What's that?
Trying to stop an act of vandalism. So I don't care anymore. Tear it up if you want. I'm a diabetic, and so we think because of the diabetes and some other, and who knows what else, basically it's all failed. So my shoulder is trash. So about once around in golf, if I get a little too far inside of my swing, my shoulder wants to sublux out the back, and it doesn't lend itself to a really good golf shot, and it hurts for a little while after. But so, yeah, that's mine.
Anything, Ryan?
I can't say that I've really seen anything out of the ordinary, like two missing clavicles. That's obviously
that's pretty good.
Pretty crazy. You know, I could say that I've seen open rotator cuffs and I've seen, you know, small little scopes totally switch realms where the big surgery, you know, major repair does fabulous and recovers well and regains their strength and their motion. And I've seen a scope that the doctor was like, yeah, I just went in there and cleaned up some fraying person.
And they suck.
They can't get over it. They're 8 months in and they still have no motion and their pain is a 10 out of 10. So, I mean, that's the most challenging thing for me as a therapist is that patients don't make sense sometimes.
Right.
And I can't figure it out and doctors can't figure it out and patients, whether it's they're malingering or if it's a true physical or just a truly mental issue, that's the most challenging thing. You know,
I think a cool thing, and I got to witness one of these to see surgically, was the old Drew Brees, that 360 labral tear. That was pretty impressive to see it and then to see it get put back together. That's a lot of suture anchors and a glenoid to hold that thing there. But it was interesting just to see the scope go into the probe and just go, oh, look, it's all off, you know. So they're not very common, obviously, but it was one of those you're like, oh wow, I'm glad I got to see that, you know. So
Matthew, weird stuff.
I know when I was on the anatomy one, I talked about the thoracic outlet surgery, but there was one I actually kind of remembered when I was first year out of my undergrad. We had this, I watched this, it was a different shoulder procedure is what the surgeon was called, and they actually called the ladder jet procedure, and I've never heard of it before.
Yeah.
So watching them literally cut the coracoid and kind of replace it onto the glenoid, I was just like blown away.
Yeah.
Like that was one of the, I don't want to call it weird, but it was something, it's a weird, different experience. Yeah, it was definitely weird to watch. And he was a, the patient was a wrestler, so his wrestling career was kind of over by then. But yeah, that was definitely something different for me to watch.
He's that athlete that rolls over in bed and dislocates.
No, yeah. I think his last ditch effort was reaching for a box of cereal and it dislocated.
I will throw this one out here. I actually just had a guy, he's a bull rider, and he's probably early 40s, so he's in the latter stages of his career. But arm up here holding down, literally dislocated his shoulder by the bull's jumping. So like he's up here doing his little thing and his arm dislocated, and not even like being thrown, just in the air, the movement, the velocity of that back and forth.
Hey, we have somewhere you need to go next year and hang out.
Mm-hmm. Try that. And then here's the sad part. He had surgery. I saw him. He did great. He said, I'm going to ride two more bulls. And on his second bull, he dislocated that same surgical shoulder. So he's going to have surgery again. Basically, I mean, the thing is probably just barely hanging on. So that's the weird part. Just like, you know, the crazy stuff I see is, you know, how you can injure your shoulder, you know, crazy stuff.
I mean, that free arm, that's a pretty good stress, but I think there's some tissue issues there too. In that,
yeah, I'm sure he's been riding bulls since he was 12.
Right, but I think at some point, and Dr. Meister mentioned this a while back, I got a chance to talk to him, at some point they're going to be able to look at somebody and go like, don't be a pitcher, or don't play cutting sports for your knees. You've got bad tissues. You know, it's going to be more scientific than an evaluation, but to say your tissues can't handle these stresses, you know. And again, that guy was probably that rubber band or that paper clip that just over – how many times have they, you know, that basketball player made that same cut that was never a problem?
Yeah, I'm sure he's been thrown and landed on that shoulder and did enough damage to it that it was just –
you know. Just a matter of time. Not if, but when. Yeah. So.
All right. So in January, let me stop my mic on. All right. So in January of 2019, I will be at the Professional Soccer Athletic Training Society workshop in Orlando. So
are you taking that suitcase?
That's actually, yes. And I know it has soccer balls on it, but I just bought something that was different. So I only needed a hard-sided suitcase to pack my stuff in that was big enough. Anyways, so PSATs. I'll be broadcasting live there with John Seco, and so I'm excited about that opportunity. And we'll get to hear about PSATs, we're going to be kind of focusing on hamstring injuries because that's a huge thing in soccer. And then we're also going to be talking to some of their vendors and things like that. So check us out in January when we're live. Definitely ask questions or email me any sort of questions, topics, comments. And then as you guys were talking about home exercise programs, MedBridge has one that a lot of people like. So if you're a member of MedBridge, you can use that and you can put exercises on there for your students, for your athletes, for your patients, and then they can log in and see those, and they have videos, that kind of thing. A lot of people say the rehab compliance increases with the home exercise program. So if you're going to use MedBridge, make sure you use the code THESMB or go to sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/MedBridge. It gets you a discount, helps out the podcast, allows me to buy cool suitcases like that one Bubba was talking about so I can carry stuff around. So we're going to start with Bubba. Someone gets to hold of, why do I even ask you? If someone wants to go to hold of Bubba, you're going to tweet him ATCLAT Bubba. So tweet Bubba. Ryan is not on social media. So the best way is probably what, email still?
Yep.
All right. And then I'll put that in the show notes. It's what, rcollins@memorialherman.org or something?
Ryan.
Ryan.collins.
Ryan.collins at memorialherman.
With two N's.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. memorialherman.org. And then Matthew,
You can reach me on Twitter, @AT_scoop1, I believe is my Twitter handle. Feel free to DM me, tweet me. Sometimes I'm busy on there, sometimes I take a little hiatus, like when it's the Thanksgiving holidays, I step away normally from all that stuff. But yep, I'm always available. Reach me out, follow me.
Very good. So again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/shoulder-rehab. This finishes up the three-part series that we had. We talked about anatomy, evaluation, and rehab. Very cool learning experience for me. And I appreciate everybody that was involved, live. And so for Matthew, for Bubba, for Ryan, and Jeremy, that is a wrap. Thanks.